From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Millions of Americans are teetering on the brink of poverty. A new report from Prosperity Now found that 40% of all U.S. households and 57% of households of color could be knocked over the edge by one unexpected medical expense, lost paycheck, or job loss. That financial instability is mirrored in housing insecurity. While homelessness in Atlanta is on the decline, Fulton County remains by far the highest among the national benchmark counties. As professor of social work at Georgia State University, Elizabeth Beck studies the roots of homelessness. She's co-author of The Homelessness Industry, a critique of U.S. social policy, and joins me in the studio. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here. And Catherine Marchman is also with us. She's executive director of the nonprofit Partners for Home, which works with the city of Atlanta to end homelessness. And Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for being here, both of you. Elizabeth, I want to start with you because you really examine homeless and homelessness and the word. How did its meaning begin changing back in the 1980s?
Well, it's important to remember that in the 1970s and before that, homelessness really existed as pockets. Pockets of time, like the Great Depression, pockets of place, like the Bowery or Skid Row. In the 1980s, we saw this massive proliferation of homelessness. It's always astounding to my students that they know that I grew up at a time when we didn't see homeless people. And as we saw this proliferation of homeless people, we began to care. We really worried about people who were homeless and their humanity and what it meant that somebody was eating out of a garbage can and what it meant that our society was allowing people to eat out of a garbage can. But as the problem grew and time continued, it became a problem of the people. So no longer was the problem that society was allowing this to occur. Now homelessness was a noun, and we spoke about the homeless and the problem laid with the people themselves.
Right. And part of this, you also look at those attitudes, I think, are an important shift, certainly. But the idea of federal housing policy and decisions connected to homelessness, your subtitle, a critique of U.S. policy. So which policies in particular led to homelessness?
Several. But one of the things that's really important to remember is there has been this shift in how we view the collective. Right. So in the 1980s, it was really known as the time of individual wealth. And it was a time in which people stopped caring about the collective or were even nervous about the collective. And so therefore, in Ronald Reagan's first few years as president, he eliminated 400,000 people from the welfare rolls. He cut the budget for subsidized housing to a quarter with the idea of getting the government out of subsidized housing forever. And so we really shifted in the 1980s as a country that cared more about profit than people. And that shows up in the issue of homelessness.
But the title of your book, Homelessness Industry, suggests that there's money being made.
You know, it's interesting. We use the term homelessness industry different than others. So other people talk about the homelessness industry as this large social service industry. We actually talk about it as the United States produces the condition of homelessness.
Uh-huh.
And we produce that condition by having this incredible mismatch between housing costs and wages or people who are needing to live on subsidies, and this total lack and loss of affordable housing options.
Well, affordable housing options seems to be the real nut of the problem. And Catherine, I'm wondering how you view these factors, housing policy, wage stagnation, the things that Elizabeth referred to, and how did those contribute to homelessness in Atlanta?
Sure. I think in Atlanta, some of what Elizabeth is touching on has been compounded. We did a study with the partnership, with the Center of Social Innovation, and they looked at some of our qualitative data and asked folks experiencing homelessness, what has led you here? And one of the large pathways into homelessness for folks in Atlanta has been network impoverishment. So essentially everything that Elizabeth's just talking about, folks in Atlanta experiencing homelessness, they're not only experiencing housing insecurity and wage stagnation, but everyone around them is experiencing those things.
So their social networks, people around them.
That's right. Their entire network. So whereas if you or I fell on hard times, lost our job, divorce, death in the family, we could lean on our mom, our dad, our brother, our sister. And the folks that are falling into homelessness just do not have that network. And the other thing that we see a great deal of is unmet health needs and significant trauma and histories and stories of violence and trauma. And for folks trying to navigate the behavioral health system without access to insurance has been, I think, another policy that has impacted folks both in their pathway to homelessness, but also in their barriers to exiting homelessness. So I think specifically to the state of Georgia, the policy around having not expanded Medicaid to date is yet another policy that has greatly impacted folks, again, both coming into homelessness, but then also being able to exit homelessness in terms of how they access and navigate the healthcare system, particularly related to mental health and substance abuse.
Do you have any kind of qualitative data on how many people who are in the homeless population are affected specifically by health problems or mental health problems, it sounds like?
You know, it's a difficult figure to put your finger on, I think, both locally and nationally. Typically, our data correlates with national data that trends around about 30% of our total population are suffering from behavioral health issues. But as you can imagine, that's a difficult question to ask somebody, and folks are not always willing to disclose that. So I think it's an area that's probably underreported.
So you're at Partners for Home coordinates the city's continuum of care, I'm putting that in quotation marks, for Atlantans affected by homelessness. Now, what does that mean, continuum of care?
The continuum of care is a term of art, and cities around the country that get it's a specific funding stream from HUD. And what that means is it's not a legal entity, but it's the continuum of care is made up of all of the homeless service providers within your community. And then HUD also requires that every community that gets that money appoints a lead agency or the collaborative applicant. So Partners for Home is the lead agency for the COC or the continuum of care. And essentially that means that we provide the strategic direction and sort of the quarterback, if you will, for homelessness. And much of our work is really focused on really shifting our focus to be more strategically focused, to get folks out of their silos and working together more impactfully, leveraging and aligning resources so that we can be a true coordinated crisis response system that moves folks out of homelessness and into housing.
That's Catherine Marchman. She is executive director of the nonprofit Partners for Home, works with the city of Atlanta to end homelessness. Also with us, Georgia State University professor Elizabeth Beck. She studies the roots of homelessness and is co-author of The Homelessness Industry. Now, Elizabeth, I wanted to, let's look at this. You know, one neighborhood we hear all over when speaking in Atlanta, how much rents have gone up, how expensive it is to get a housing among many people, not just low-income people. But looking at one neighborhood and rapid gentrification in recent years, let's look at Atlanta's Inman Park. How is that neighborhood a microcosm of what happens when people struggle with housing insecurity?
Well, I think one of the issues is that Inman Park, as those gorgeous houses became renovated into single-family homes, it's important to remember that previously there had been multiple people living in those homes, and they lived in a situation where they had a shared bathroom and a hot plate, and they had enough money to be able to live week to week in a boarding house type home. And in the 1970s, we lost over 3 million of those types of housing, the affordable housing that people had where they could be the poorest of the poor and still have a roof over their head.
So was that just the market, or was that, again, you talked about policy in the 1980s. What was going on in the 70s that led to that?
Well, a variety of things, but one of them was rental subsidies. There was certainly the whole process of renovating downtowns in which a number of people who lived in low-income areas were removed for downtown gentrification or downtown businesses. The whole process of gentrification and how people began to get subsidies more for strategies like that as opposed to
Actually putting the money into the housing itself. Well, this is something that came up just a couple of weeks before Atlanta hosted the Super Bowl. The city announced it would work to clear homeless encampments. Now, Catherine, you've cared and advocated for individuals experiencing homelessness for over 20 years. How do laws like this, that removal as the local ordinance prohibiting homeless encampments, affect these populations? Catherine?
I mean, I think it is challenging. Partners for Home, when this happens, what we try to do is coordinate all the homeless service providers to come together to the table to try to offer services and outreach and engagement to folks who are sleeping outside. And this plays into our larger strategy of really, again, trying to coordinate and strategically align the services to do this work more impactfully. Historically, we've had outreach teams that are going out into the city and, you know, they're all going to Woodruff Park. And so that doesn't make a lot of sense and help us do our work more impactfully because we have folks all over the city.
Mm-hmm. So that's just the most visible or one of the most visible encampments. And that's why the attention is focused there.
Right, exactly. And I mean, I think one of the challenges is if we're clearing an encampment, we're just moving folks somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so we see a lot of the work that we're doing for folks specifically who are sleeping outside is slow and steady work. It takes quite some time to build a relationship and trust with somebody who's outside. Many folks who are sleeping outside are there because they may have had challenges or struggles in an emergency shelter. They might have mental health issues where it's causing them to experience a lot of paranoia, and they might be afraid to be around a lot of people. So there's a lot of reasons that lead somebody to sleep outside or choose to sleep outside. And so outreach has to be, is often a long-term game where we are working with folks, again, to build relationship, but with the ultimate goal of moving them towards permanent housing.
Well, taking that long view means staying away from the triage model. And your organization and many others that serve individuals experiencing homelessness has shifted from this crisis response model to one that focuses on housing. Now, what does that mean exactly?
That's right. Historically, we operated in a housing-ready mind frame, which meant we would put people through these hoops and barriers and requirements in order to prove themselves ready for housing. Instead, we operate on a housing-first approach, and what that means is you don't have to be ready for everyone's ready for housing, that housing is a human right, and housing is the foundation by which we do everything else. So all of our HUD-funded permanent supportive housing programs are required to operate on a housing-first basis. It means there's no requirements for treatment, there's no sobriety requirements, there's no employment requirements. It really means that we've broken down all those barriers, we put somebody in housing first, and then we attach services to that individual to help them meet client-driven goals. And there's a wealth of evidence base out there around the country and internationally as well that shows that this is the most effective way of ending homelessness and keeping people from returning to homelessness.
All right, we're going to cut for a break in just a minute, but how about the mental health treatment? How do people who are working in that reach people who are homeless? Do they have to come to them?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a big part of our outreach strategy. We have just funded a brand new five-person outreach team that's going to be dedicated in the downtown and midtowns areas. And we're staffing that team with a licensed clinical social worker for that reason. But again, I think going back to the policy question, ineffective behavioral health services was another one of our qualitative findings for folks with barriers to exiting homelessness. And so we have to address access to behavioral health care as well.
Catherine Marchman and Elizabeth Beck are sticking around. We're going to take a short break and talk a little bit more about homelessness in Atlanta today, causes and possibly cures. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, continuing and wrapping up our conversation on homelessness, which came into sharp focus when the city of Atlanta cleared out homeless encampments before the Super Bowl. Elizabeth Beck, co-author of The Homelessness Industry, is with me. Also, Catherine Marchman, executive director of Partners for Home, which coordinates with the city of Atlanta's continuum of care for people experiencing homelessness. Elizabeth, I want to get back to the clearing out encampments and busing homeless people out of town. These things are not new. This happened during the Olympics. Not unique to Atlanta, but what do local policies and actions like that tell us about what you spoke of earlier, societal attitudes towards homelessness?
It really speaks to the idea that homeless people are the problem as opposed to a society that creates the condition of homelessness through housing and wages. and that as the problem, homeless people are there for the target of, you are hurting my neighborhood, you're hurting my backyard, you're hurting my downtown. And as the problem, they are then placed in prisons or jails, which have been a way in which people have dealt with homelessness for a very long time, is to criminalize the activities that homeless people do and escort them into jails or escort them out of towns or to break up encampments. And again, it's the problem is that it's no longer that we have a problem of homelessness, but that homeless people are creating a problem for us and our quality of life. And that's a response in which there's very little humanity.
But Catherine, this is something that you can't, it's not easy to legislate attitudes. And you have been talking about the ways that you and the city are taking action and changing policy to address this kind of shift in the way that we think of homeless people. So let's talk about a little bit about what are possible paths of moving away from homelessness.
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest thing that we're focused on right now is scaling permanent housing solutions. That is essentially the end game, and that's the only thing that's actually going to end a person's homelessness is housing.
What do you mean by scaling?
So we are currently in the process of building 550 new units of permanent supportive housing. We need to create sustainable ways to continue to create new units of supportive housing. In addition to that, we are investing in rapid rehousing for folks who are not disabled. So permanent supportive housing is specifically for individuals experiencing chronic homelessness. That means they have a disabling condition and they've been homeless for a long time. So what we're trying to do is scale in a right-sized way. So right-sizing our system by population because, again, we don't want to just pair the next housing intervention to the next person that walks in the door. We want to do it in an evidence-based way that makes sense for the unique needs of the individual person. And so we're investing a great deal of resources in new units of supportive housing, of aligning resources. So the housing authority is at the table and they are offering ongoing rental subsidy to a current RFP that we have open for the development of those units. And then, again, like I said, scaling rapid rehousing for other populations, which is essentially just a flexible subsidy. But it does hinge on the availability of affordable units within our community, which is going to be an ongoing challenge.
Catherine Marchman, Executive Director of the nonprofit Partners for Home, which works with the City of Atlanta to end homelessness. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And Elizabeth Beck, Professor at Georgia State University and co-author of The Homelessness Industry. Thank you.
Thank you.
In December, Effingham County authorities made a grisly discovery, the bodies of two children buried behind their family's home, 14-year-old Mary Crocker and her brother, Elwin Crocker Jr., who was 14 when he died 2 years ago. At different times, both children were pulled out of public school to be homeschooled. The Crocker case was a shock and prompted some state legislators in the area to research issues of homeschooling and abuse. Georgia Representative Bill Hitchens is among them, a Republican representing Rincon and Chairman of the Public Safety and Homeland Security Committee, joining me on the line from his hometown in Effingham County. Thank you so much for taking the time, Representative Hitchens.
Well, thank you very much for taking up this issue. It's certainly an important issue that affects not only people here where this terrible incident occurred, but it affects people all over the country. And I think we need to shine a little more light on it than has been in the past.
Well, also joining us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Samantha Field, policy advocate and board member for the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. Samantha, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Representative Hitchens, what prompted authorities to first visit the Crocker home?
I think it was an anonymous phone call. First, a tipster called and related that they thought there was a problem there. And I think as they look back on it, there had been a problem there for some time. And then when they went out there and started interviewing the occupants of the trailer, some of the information started to come forward.
Now, you live just 5 miles from the Crocker home. How have your neighbors reacted to this news?
Well, I think everybody in Effingham County is pretty much distraught by what occurred. You know, this is a fairly well-off county. You know, we have one of the better school systems in the state. We are just adjacent to Savannah. Many of the people here work at Gulfstream Air Base, the ports, and have a pretty good income. And they just can't imagine that, just like in many other instances I've been involved with throughout my law enforcement careers, they just can't imagine that it happened here.
Mm. Well, Samantha, your organization is called the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, founded in 2013, made up of homeschool alums. Some had good experiences and some did not. Why was it founded?
So, because we're all homeschool alumni, we looked around and realized that there were lots of organizations that advocate on behalf of parents and guardians who want to home educate their children, but there were no organizations that advocated on behalf of homeschooled students themselves. So we were founded to advocate for the homeschooled students, to raise awareness for needed reforms that could help protect homeschooled students, and to offer resources to those who want to make sure that their homeschooling experience is as successful as possible, and to offer policy guidance to legislators, family services, etc.
So what are the current requirements for homeschooling here in Georgia?
So in Georgia, there is a requirement that they notify the State Department of Education that they intend to homeschool their children. And they're supposed to complete so many days of school for like 4.5 hours every day. But unfortunately, none of those additional requirements, there's no means of monitoring that, to making sure that education is happening, that the children are being, like, progressing in an appropriately, developmentally appropriate way, and to make sure that situations like the Crocker case don't happen. Those protections don't exist in Georgia.
Now, Representative Hitchens, you've been looking into recommendations like that, working with other lawmakers. How do you think this could work for Georgians?
Well, you got to be very careful what you do. Homeschooling, I think, is a basic constitutional right. And what we don't want to do is to become emotional about this and produce a law that is going to constrain those people who do things the right way. You know, like I said, I've been in law enforcement my whole life, and typical trigger we use in the law enforcement community is probable cause. You know, you have to have probable cause to believe that some violation of the law has occurred before there can be any action. We get a lot of kickback on that, because things happen in the community where people say, "Why didn't you do something about that?" Well, if you don't know, or there's not any evidence, you can't do anything about it. And but it's a constitutional guarantee. What we've looked at here is where there's a trigger in the homeschooling. You know, Ms. Field has been great for me to work with. We had a long conversation the other day, and I think we're on the same page insofar as what kind of triggers might come up. We're researching it still. We've met with the state director of DFACS, the people at the Georgia Department of Education, and law enforcement, and everybody we can to try and come up with a proper way to go about instituting some new legislation to make or tail this in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things are, one of them is truancy. If children don't come to school on a regular basis, usually it's an interaction from the school, some type of response. You know, if teachers and administrators are mandatory reporters, if they see abuse or neglect, they're required to report it. DFACS gets involved. And oftentimes, shortly thereafter, children are withdrawn and homeschooled, and they become invisible to just about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that was the case with both of these children. So, you know, we're looking at maybe having some form of trigger when something like that occurs, that DFACS gets further involved and makes visits to the home.
Well, you're making a great point. I mean, you know, the homeschooling movement gained ground in opposition to inadequate public education, sometimes
That's
on religious
correct.
Grounds, concerns about school safety, and mandated methods by federal education policy. So this is a population that doesn't want the government on its back. How do you, Samantha, you and your coalition, what kind of trigger mechanisms, as Representative Hitchens put it, can you put in place to a population that is largely unmonitored?
So One of the things that we're finding in the research that we do and just kind of keeping track as much as possible of what kind of goes on in home education environments is that there is a pattern across the country of parents and guardians having an encounter with Department of Family and Children Services, and at that point realize that their abuse has been spotted. And then they look to things like Georgia's home study program and say, I can exploit this. This is a loophole that exists for me. I don't want any more encounters with children services, so I'm going to withdraw my children from school and isolate them. We see this happening all across the country. For example, the Office of the Child Advocate in Connecticut put together a report looking at school districts across the entire state and found that 36% of the time the children were being withdrawn from traditional school to be home educated, there were reports of abuse. 90% of the time, those reports were founded reports of abuse or a history of multiple reports of abuse. So if, for example, somebody has an encounter with Georgia's Department of Family Services, at that point, if they try to withdraw their children from school in order to isolate them, in order to exploit the homeschool statute that exists in Georgia, that we could empower the Department of Education, the local school board, the Department of Family and Children Services to say, hey, let's work with you on this case. Maybe homeschooling is the best option for you and your child in this situation, but let's make sure before we just let you go without any kind of more monitoring or oversight or accountability.
Now, of course, we want to make the point that students who go to public and private schools are also subject to abuse and neglect. But the fact that they are going to school with mandated reporting can affect how far an abuser can truly go. Now, Samantha, your organization, the CHRE, keeps a database called Homeschooling's Invisible Children, specifically tracking cases where homeschooling was used as a cover to isolate, abuse, and neglect children. Now, how do you track that?
So most of the time, it's only what's reported in the news. If a case is typically egregious enough or shocking enough, there will be reporting on it in the news. And anytime that news sources discover that a home education statute was a part of how the abuse was covered up or concealed, we keep track of that. But very often we're not able to confirm that right when the abuse happens. We have cases where we'll hear about a report and we might suspect that exploitation of a home education statute was involved, but it could take a year or more until we're able to confirm that. Sometimes we use court cases to try to keep track of it, but our database is admittedly minimal. Even so, we have over a dozen cases that occurred in Georgia alone since 2002. And looking at all of our cases broadly, what we're finding is that homeschool children and public school children are very often experiencing abuse and neglect at similar rates, but the lethality is much worse because isolation is such an important risk factor for abuse and neglect. And because things like starving your children to death can happen more easily if they're being homeschooled. Of course, homeschooling isn't usually happening in the situations. They're just exploiting the statute. Yeah. So those things can be worsened, and homeschooling can make abuse more lethal for children.
Well,
because there's no oversight.
Representative Hitchens, you know, therein lies the rub, right? The Crocker case, the 21st Georgia case listed in the CRHE database. So how are you going to approach that balance of people having the right to the privacy to educate their children as they wish to, and the fact that they are untracked and could be exploiting a loophole in the law in order to abuse their children in privacy?
Well, I think Ms. Field said it. What we have to do is to develop that process where those who are number one, who are moved out of the school system and homeschooled as a result of some type of issue that comes forward with that may have involved abuse or neglect, and making sure that that they're checked on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing we've looked at is this family came from South Carolina. There was domestic abuse in the family over there. There was a divorce. The mother actually did something that was very uncredible, and she lost credibility with the police department. So it was the children were awarded to the husband. He came over here. He remarried. And I think things went pretty well. They had some problems when they lived in the city of Rincon. There were some contacts with police. And then they moved out and lived with the grandmother, who was his new wife's mother. And the people in the neighborhood out there said they saw issues, and they wish now that they'd reported them, but they didn't. So what we need to do is better tracking and get the school system and DFAC to work together, which they already do. And I think there needs to be some interstate
investigation.
You know, transfer, well, informational. If somebody called over there and then found out, see, when the boy disappeared, nobody even knew he was gone.
Representative Hitchens, I'm sorry that we have to leave it there. An important discussion, but appreciate hearing from Georgia Representative Bill Hitchens, Republican from Rincon, Chairman of the Public Safety and Homeland Security Committee. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Samantha Fields, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. What began as a campaign rallying cry?
We're going to have a wall. We're going to have a barrier. We're going to have something that's going to be very strong.
Became a core issue for the Trump administration, leading to an historic government shutdown.
These are steel barriers in high priority locations. That is our plan. Border security, DACA, TPS, and many other things. Straightforward, fair, reasonable, and common sense with lots of compromise.
Democrats rejected that plan, and last Friday, President Trump declared a state of emergency to access funding for a border wall that Congress refused to give him. The political stalemate leaves undocumented students in flux, the very students served by Freedom University in Atlanta. Executive Director Emiko Soltis is here to talk us about the Freedom School model that was launched in the civil rights era and how it's supporting these students today. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Also with us, Arizbet Sanchez and Raymond Partolan. They're both DACA recipients who work with Freedom U, and thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
Hi, Arizbet. Thank you for being here. Emiko, I'm going to start with you, though, a little on Freedom University's origins, the Freedom School idea, where it started and why.
Great. The Freedom School idea was really birthed during the height of the Black Freedom Movement and the Civil Rights era in particular. Many people know about 1964 Freedom Summer when student activists with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee went down to Mississippi. And many people remember Freedom Summer for its voter registration drives, but many people forget about the legacy of the Freedom Schools that were established. And the point of the Freedom Schools was to really mobilize Black citizens in Mississippi and provide completely free classes for them. But the whole goal was to create politically conscious and politically active people in Mississippi. And that whole model is also based on the idea that education can be liberatory, that mm-hmm. education can be for action and political action. And the curriculum was also very culturally relevant and based on the needs of the students. And teaching was more based on dialogue rather than lecturing and really focused on students being experts in their own lives, and that teachers were also learning from students rather than just lecturing them.
So this was relaunched here in Atlanta in 2003. Why then?
It was actually in 2011, right after Policy 416 and 434, which were passed by the Georgia Board of Regents in the fall of 2010, banned undocumented students from the top public universities and from in-state tuition throughout the state. And so Freedom University was founded in the fall of 2011 and was brought to Atlanta in 2013 in order to provide undocumented students who are banned from public higher education a space where they could continue their education in a safe environment and learn from university professors from throughout Atlanta to really restore their sense and love of learning and really learn that they have human rights and the right to education, regardless of what state's policies might be.
Now, Freedom U organized a protest last week during a Georgia Board of Regents meeting to change those policies, forbidding students from DACA recipients from getting in-state tuition and getting entry into these institutions. What are you proposing?
Right. So this direct action was on Tuesday, February 12th. And this is in a long history of direct action that Freedom University students engage in. At Freedom University, yes, we provide completely free college-level classes. We provide college application and scholarship assistance so that one in three of our students wins a full scholarship to college. But we also engage in, again, this Freedom School goal of creating engaged, politically active young people, right? And so a part of that is this movement leadership training, which involves encouraging students who want to make sure that their voice on issues of immigration and access to education are being heard. And so a part of that involves direct actions. And so we, in this particular case, there are 9 people, 4 ministers, 3 teachers, a community member, and Comedy Central host, Jordan Klepper, who disrupted this Board of Regents meeting, really bringing attention to the fact that these policies have been in place for 9 years, these bans. Policy 416, again, which is one of only 3 states, Georgia is one of 3 states that actually have a type of admissions ban from public higher education, and also an in-state tuition ban, which is essentially an economic ban prohibiting undocumented young people from equal access to public higher education. And so the point of the protest was to bring attention to these policies, recognize that this is within a long history of educational segregation in the South, and that Georgia is violating undocumented students' human right to education under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 26.
Okay, and we have 2 of those politically active DACA recipients and students with us, or former students, Arizbeth and Raymond, both DACA recipients, as I said. Raymond, I want to start with you a little bit about growing up in Macon. What was that experience like for you?
Sure. So, again, thank you for having me on the show. I moved to the United States when I was 1 from the Philippines, and my family came here legally on a work visa. And we didn't become undocumented, per se, until I was 10 years old, and we had settled in Macon, Georgia. And growing up in Macon was a huge challenge, being outside of the metro Atlanta area, being farther down south in Georgia. I literally grew up right down the road from farm fields and livestock. And growing up there was a challenge insofar as I felt like there was no one around me that understood my struggle as an undocumented person. Mm. When I found out I was undocumented at the age of 10, I was in the 5th grade, and I had no idea what being undocumented would one day mean in my life. My parents told me that I was an illegal alien, and I went and told my best friend at the time that I was an illegal alien. And he said, Raymond, there is no way that you're an illegal alien because aliens come from outer space and they're green, and you are neither one of those things. And at that point, I thought, wow, this can't be that bad. And it wasn't until I got to high school when I started to really understand what it meant to be undocumented.
Yeah, take that in. How about for you, Arizbeth? You grew up in Norcross. What was that experience like for you? And that realization, when did it come for you?
Well, thank you for having us here. For me, so my family came when I was 6 years old, and I always knew that I was undocumented. I think growing up, you just take up a lot of responsibilities, and you sort of realize that this is not normal. And so I always knew that it was that I was undocumented.
Yeah. Well, so Atlanta, of course, has a reputation for embracing diversity, but anti-immigration sentiment has existed in the city and the state, certainly, which narrowly elected Brian Kemp as governor, who made his views on the issue clear in this ad during the primary campaign.
I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. Yep, I just said that. I'm Brian Kemp. If you want a politically incorrect conservative, that's me.
Well, then that politically incorrect conservative self-described was elected governor. So what did conversations sound like and look like for you during the election of 2018 when all of these issues were stirring up and at the forefront of candidates' platforms, Raymond?
Sure. So I actually worked tirelessly to prevent the election of Brian Kemp into office. I led and managed an effort called Asians for Abrams. And I directed a volunteer effort of people knocking on thousands of doors to get the word out about Stacey Abrams. I think it's important for people to realize that elections have consequences. The governor of the state of Georgia has the power to appoint the members of the Board of Regents. And as Emiko said, in 2010, the Board of Regents was the very policymaking body that promulgated these policies that currently ban undocumented students. And had our election in 2018 had a different outcome, we may be having a different conversation today about whether undocumented students could have access to our public colleges and universities here in our state.
Well, of course, campaigns often target emotions over the facts. And we do know, you know, there are criminal crimes committed by immigrants are by far lower than in the general population. But how do you think these prevailing beliefs that you grew up with, the people who are around you in your neighborhood or Arizpet in your neighborhood in Norcross, match up with the reality? Anyone want to pick that up?
Right. So I would say that as an undocumented person growing up, I wasn't around very many undocumented people. It wasn't until I got to high school and I attended a program actually at the University of Georgia, a school that I am currently banned from as an undocumented person, called Leadership Sin Limites, or Leadership Without Limits, translated into English. And it was at that program in the summer of 2010 that I finally met other undocumented people just like me. And these were people who were excelling in school. Who were passionate about their education and who wanted nothing more than to make this country a better place. I graduated from high school in 2011, a year after these bans took into effect. And I can certainly say that these bans affected me very personally. And I thought that no matter how hard I worked in school, there was a very likely chance that I wouldn't be able to make something out of my life, that I wouldn't have the chance to go to college. And I think that so many other people across this country face that same reality.
Raymond Partalin, he's from Freedom University, also with me, Arizpet Sanchez from the university, and Emiko Soltis, who's the executive director. And this is something, while some DACA recipients are protected from deportation, oftentimes their family members are not, and Georgia does have one of the highest deportation rates in the country. So, Emiko, how does Freedom University help students go through this experience of a parent or family member being deported?
Right. I appreciate what you said about DACA as well, but it's important for people to understand that many undocumented young people also don't qualify for DACA,
right, exactly,
which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that was announced by the Obama administration in 2015. And what's important to remember, June 15th, 2012, what's important for people to understand is that 1 in 13 children in Georgia has an undocumented family member, right? Many of our undocumented students don't qualify for DACA, and almost all of their parents don't have any type of authorization to be in the United States or any protection in the United States. And so what this means is that oftentimes young people are growing up in Georgia and across the United States living in constant fear of deportation and family separations. And while it's important that family separations really came into the national spotlight this year with focus on the border and family separation policies, many people forget that deportations in itself are family separations, right? And it's really important to recognize that immigration issues aren't solely at the border, but they're happening in our communities here in Georgia and in cities across the United States.
Right, but we don't have the same optics. We don't see it in the same way, especially when we're talking about young children. So I'm wondering for you, Arizpet and Raymond, you know, that kind of uncertainty and powerlessness with immigration status is very stressful. So Arizpet, how do you and the staff support students experiencing that kind of trauma?
At Freedom University, we make sure that our students always feel safe. Freedom University is one of the first places where they sort of become vulnerable and sort of tell other people that they are undocumented. It's mm-hmm. a safe place where you can talk about your experiences, what's happening at home. And so we make that space safe at all times for students. If anything is happening, if you want to talk about anything on the news, this is the time to do it for people with people who understand your situation and who can sort of provide support and a sort of solution
so
as a community.
What kind of conversations does that lead to, Emika?
The conversations, like we mentioned, based on the Freedom School model, is that at our core, the students' lives are at the center of what we're teaching and what we're discussing, again, based on dialogue. But rather than simply talk about current events, we also talk about history and the making of illegal immigration and different types of race-based bans and quotas that have always been a part of the U.S. immigration system. And oftentimes, this gives students context into the current political climate, that this didn't come from nowhere. Mm. And it's really important for people, especially in Georgia, to understand that, one, this used to be indigenous land, right? And the many people who are undocumented are descendants of indigenous people of these lands. So if we think about the terms illegal and who that really benefits when we are calling human beings illegal rather than certain acts, right? And people who were on Wall Street who were tanking the economy and engaging in white-collar crime, we don't call them illegal bankers, right? That there is power involved in these terms, right? That we're calling young people who went kindergarten through 12th grade in Georgia public schools, whose families are paying taxes, state, federal taxes into Social Security, whose benefits they will never receive, and calling them illegal. I think it's important to look at the larger social system and who that benefits when we are looking down for the source of our problems rather than looking up.
Well, Raymond, now you're working as an immigration paralegal, taking folks through the system.
Right.
So what does that mean for you, helping families through this process when it's something that you yourself have gone through?
Sure. As you mentioned, I currently work as an immigration paralegal at one of the largest immigration law firms in the state of Georgia, Cook Baxter Immigration. And I think that having personally experienced our immigration system and after currently experiencing our immigration system, it helps me to better connect with the clients that we serve. It helps me to better understand their struggle and to understand how difficult it is to navigate our system. Our immigration system is outdated and it is in need of some major reform. And at this point, the only legislative body that can do that for us is Congress. And for many years, Congress has neglected to act on this issue. There are over 11 million undocumented people that live here in our country who whose futures are uncertain. Every single day, these people wake up and they don't know whether they're going to be able to drive to work and come home and see their kids again. And the time is now for Congress to stand up and say, we need to fix our broken immigration system. And I think it's important for people to know that over 65,000 undocumented students graduate from high schools across the country every single year. And the majority of these kids don't have the opportunity to go to college. As Emiko said, Georgia, South Carolina, and Alabama are three of the worst states in our country.
But you're hitting on a red meat issue for many conservatives who say that we shouldn't be paying for these people. You know that they are they don't belong here. They didn't come here legally. So I know it's a big thing to leave for this, but we've got half a minute left. Emiko, what's your response to those people in that argument?
Those people often, the rallying cry of the Tea Party movement and a lot of conservatives is that there should not be taxation without representation. Undocumented people are paying $7 billion into Social Security per year. DACA eligible young people pay $1.7 billion in state and local taxes each year. They're paying taxes into this system, but they have no representation and no right to vote. This is a long history in the United States of accepting labor and denying people's civil and human rights.
Emiko Soltis, she is Executive Director of Freedom University, Arisbeth Sanchez, and Raymond Partolin. They work with Freedom University, both DACA recipients. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for today. We will be back with more on Second Thought tomorrow, where, of course, we're on Facebook, on Twitter. You can stay in touch with us there.